Mental health and mental disorders have taken the center stage in news stories in recent weeks. An estimated 26% of Americans ages 18 and older, now think about that, that's one in four adults, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder in any given year. Nearly half of American adults will suffer with a mental illness of some form in their lifetime, but of course, mental illness not only affects adults, it also affects children. Left untreated, mental illness can have devastating effects. Suicide has risen to the 10th leading cause of death in the United States and third leading cause among 15 to 24-year-olds. And sometimes we see much more dramatic and tragic results, such as the Washington Navy Yard tragedy that occurred last week that may have been linked to mental illness. When we discuss these illnesses, what exactly do we mean? And when we need help, how do we find it? Well, those are just a couple of the questions we'll discuss tonight on Health Matters. I'm Kermit Poling, and I'm joined in the studio by Laura Brusha Hamm, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Families, and also Dr. Richard Price, a clinician at the Center for Families in Shreveport. And of course, you can join in the conversation by calling us at 800-552-8502. Again, our number, 800-552-8502. Laura and Richard, thank you both for joining me here and joining all of us listening tonight to Health Matters. When we talk about mental health, what exactly are we referring to? What are some of the conditions that fall under a mental health disorder?
Well, thank you so much, first of all, Kermit, for having us. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys. You know, there's so many disorders or so many health challenges that people face, but some of the most common ones that we see, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, personality disorders. You have other, you know, more focused areas like sleep disorders, for example. And I have a Dr. Richard Price here that can comment and talk more about, as a clinician, about some of the work that he does. So if you'd like to add.
Well, thank you, Laura. Sure, depression and anxiety are very common, substance abuse. The different mood disorders, which involve not only depression, but sometimes a manic state or a cycling between a manic and a depressed state, panic attacks, post-traumatic stress disorder, and then a general category we call somatoform disorders, which are those that affect us physically. Sometimes we have a physical problem that has psychological components, and sometimes we're affected psychologically by our physical problems as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask, since you mentioned, of course, depression, and we all at one time or another feel depressed, what's the difference between feeling depressed and true depression?
That's a great question, and I will definitely let Dr. Price elaborate on that. But everybody at some point can experience some moments of feeling depressed. And when does it get to a point where I need to ask or call out and reach out for a resource and get some support? And that's when you need to look at whether you are a family member or it's yourself. Are things different in your life? Are you feeling more hopeless? Do you feel that nobody supports you? Are you having suicidal thoughts, which can be more of a severe state of depression?
Becoming isolated from mm-hmm. others, whether it's at work or in the family, certainly suicidal thoughts are things that may suggest that a person is thinking about suicide. It might be they're leaving, giving things away to other people,
right.
Or maybe there are notes or little offhand comments. And actually, in terms of looking at depression and trying to evaluate whether it's just a normal time when you're feeling down versus very serious depression. Another thing to really watch for, in addition to hopelessness, feelings of hopelessness or helplessness, and also seeing that the person is having trouble at home or at the job or just in their own personal feelings, another thing is their physiological response. There are many things that are affected by depression. Sleep is very important, but also appetite and energy, sexual interest, and many others, difficulty concentrating, are part of a picture of very serious depression. And certainly the things that concern us most are acts where a person might want to harm themselves or might not take good care of themselves, and in fact, because of that, result in injury to themselves or to somebody else. So all those would be indicators that there might be a very serious depression.
Do you find that it's more difficult for someone to see these things in themselves? Because you mentioned some things from the third person. If you see someone, you know, their changes in their life, you know, things that you can recognize. But is that not trickier for someone to see that themselves?
You're pointing at me. Yes, I would think so. It can be a lot trickier to seem at yourself with yourself because you're so used to certain routines. And so when you're not in your normal state and you're in a process of depression, of that hopelessness or that helplessness, it's not as easy to identify where you are in that moment unless there's a loved one that may be able to point those things out to you, because you're so engrossed in what is going on right then and there that sometimes we don't make that connection of something has shifted.
Yeah, that's really important. I think that one of the things that's often true in a serious depression is that the person will begin to experience what we might call tunnel vision, and they really don't see many options, and sometimes, unfortunately, wind up feeling that there is no other option other than hurting themselves. And certainly if we see anything like that, we want to try to intervene in a way that would be encouraging, helpful, but firm, so the person would get the help that they need.
The number to call tonight, 1-800-552-8502, to participate in Health Matters tonight. And we're going to be discussing mental illnesses and treatments and how to seek treatment for that. Again, my guests are Laura Bruchier-Hamm and Dr. Richard Price, both from the Center for Families in Shreveport. So call in with your question or comment this evening. Again, 800-552-8502. We do have one question that has come through online, so I'm just going to relay this to you. If a person has had several accidents involving head injuries as a child, could that person be more at risk with mental health issues as an adult?
Well, I would say yes. Even injuries as an adult, there's a category that we call traumatic brain injury that there may not be, an injury that someone else would notice, but perhaps a concussion while playing sports or something like that can have a cumulative effect and affect the person's ability to remember, to concentrate, and affect their moods as well, and in some cases can become very serious.
With, again, the number, if you have a question tonight, 800-552-8502, how, from the standpoint of your practice, how are mental health problems assessed when someone seeks treatment?
Well, of course, there are different ways that people assess, but I think that most clinicians would agree that probably the most important piece is to do a good clinical interview. What that means is to review some of the significant features in the person's history and their what we would call their presenting complaint, what they come in complaining of, their mental health history, their family history, and certainly reviewing things concerning their use of different either drugs or alcohol, what their behavior has been like. If you are able to find out about their behavior as a child, their relationship with their family, what their behavior in adolescence, and if they're an adult, what their job history has been, what perhaps if they've been married, as much information as you can about the person's background, different kinds of problems, perhaps treatment that they've had before, as well as finding out what exactly are they concerned about at the time. In addition to a good clinical interview, there are also assessment forms that are given to the individual when they first come in for treatment. Sometimes there are folks who are referred for psychological testing, and that can be helpful as well. But I think most clinicians would agree that clinical interview is probably the most important and definitive way of assessing mental illness.
How long of a period of time does it take when you first meet a patient to sort out basically what's going on?
Well, If I can, I would answer mm-hmm. that and just say that it varies a lot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's quite obvious, can be a fairly specific kind of problem that they are presenting to you. However, in other cases, they may have quite a few things that are bothering them at the time, and they may come in with one particular problem, but behind it may be several others that are equally important once you get to know them better. So I would say that certainly that initial interview is really important. When possible, I like to have at least an hour and a half to talk to that person. But even after that, I may finish that time with them and still have questions in my mind about perhaps it may be clear what their presenting issue is, but I may be asking myself questions that I'll need to follow up on later about what some other possible issues might be.
Sure. Do you find that there are still a lot of people who believe that there's really a stigma against getting help?
Absolutely. It's a huge problem in our country. And that is definitely something that we are hoping that we can make a difference in the community. You know, when you look at the media, whether it's commercials or movies and how people are portrayed when they have mental illness diagnosis or even just a general breakdown of some sort or grieving, it's so easy to see in the media using derogatory terms towards people. Mm-hmm. And so that helps, of course, instill that stigma. And so there needs to be a shift, and we're hoping that with education and awareness and discussions like this, that there can be a difference in educating people that the brain is so complicated. And even though it helps us to do everything from speaking right now to looking at you to how we feel, there's that nurture and nature component. So the nature of the chemical changes that can happen that sometimes we need psychiatric help for. And then, of course, the nurture, as Dr. Price is talking about, you know, finding out about childhood or about environment, family and social settings, and how all of those interact and affect the mind and how people end up behaving in society. And so every time we see a person behaving in such a way that we don't think is appropriate, typically we respond with fear, and then typically we respond with not very good reactions that help create that stigma.
I'll just add to that about the issue of stigma. I completely agree with you that there often is a stigma. I do think that changes somewhat over time and with regard to culture. Mm-hmm. I know I did my graduate training in California in the mid-70s, and there were some people within that culture there that liked to tell about having a therapist. They would sort of say, well, my therapist is. They would name a different person. But that's not too common. The other thing I would add is that I think that folks, in addition to a general stigma, I think that there are also some people who perhaps because of their job or their social position find it very, very important to maintain a certain image. Mm-hmm. And they may be concerned about maintaining that image, or they may worry that receiving mental health care might affect their job.
Mm-hmm. The number to call with your question this evening, 1-800-552-8502. You can get in on the conversation this evening discussing mental health and, of course, the treatment of mental health issues. 1-800-552-8502. You referred to the culture in California, and this kind of leads me to my next question, because wanted to ask about the disparities in different cultures, in different backgrounds, and how that affects how people are treated. And one thing that came to mind, there was an article in the Washington Post, and this was about Aaron Alexis, of course, who was the shooter at the Navy Yard in Washington. And to many people, he came across as normal. I'm just going to paraphrase the article. He heard voices, saw imaginary people, believed someone was bombarding him. He asked for help from his employer, but basically was told all he needed was a few days of rest. But what the article primarily goes into is that in the culture in which he was working, and primarily coming from an African-American background, mm-hmm. That the consequences of mental illness among black men in particular is much more frequent because the culture behind it is also a little different. The idea of getting help for a mental issue is a much tougher subject to come across. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, I think in general that women are more likely to seek care, and that Caucasians are more likely to seek care than Hispanics or Blacks. Why that is difficult to know, and there are people who have studied that in depth.
There are some studies, and it's interesting because I like to have conversations with everybody to find out also, why are you more comfortable in asking for help versus someone else? And I find that a lot of my African-American friends say, well, we like to keep it in the family, which also relates to my ethnic culture of being Italian. It's the same thing. You keep it in the family. You know, it's something that is either discussed in the family or it's swept under the rug.
Right.
So those cultural factors are very important, and looking at exactly how do they behave in that family unit.
All right, we'll come back to that a little bit. We have our first caller, so I'm going to open up the phones right now. This is Ben from Dry Prong. I want to thank you so much for waiting on hold. Ben, go ahead with your question this evening. Ben from Dry Prong, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, there's a delay if you listen on the air, so you'll, for at least while the time you're asking your question, want to just stay with the phone.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, my mother has schizophrenia. She developed, right after I was born, she developed postpartum depression, and it blew. It grew into full schizophrenia. Her primary fallacy was paranoia. After my father passed away, she came to live with me. And I found that the best, not just having kids and stuff, grandkids around, but the best thing that I could do for her was actually to get her physician and her psychologist talking. You know, to where they were able to better prescribe medication and stuff, and it really, really changed her. Her last 7 or 8 years before she passed away was probably the best she had. Is that more common nowadays? Is it easier to get physicians and psychologists working together? Because I really had to fight with it there for a while.
I don't know how to respond in terms of if it's generally changed, but certainly what our practice is when we do see somebody, to find out if they are being treated for whatever their problem might be by anybody else, whether that might be a physician or another therapist. And if the person is willing to, ask them to sign a release of information to authorize a free exchange. Without that authorization on their part, we are very, very limited in terms of when we can share information. Actually, we can only do that when required to do so by law. So it's really important that the person give us their permission. But thank you so much for the question. I'm really glad that that happened for your mom before she passed away.
Yeah, and I'd like to comment. First of all, I think, Ben, that was an excellent question because you bring up a very important point, and that is the collaborative effort. Mm-hmm. It is so critical important to bring together physicians, if there's a psychiatrist involved, you know, the counselor, if there are other, what we call, I'm sorry, I'm going blank on it, but just your non-professional entity, such as perhaps there's a minister at the church or there's an older brother down the road. It's so critical to bring all of those natural environments to the table in order to provide support, not only for that individual, but that entire family unit. And that, when we see that happen, we see more success move forward in a quicker manner. And so thanks for bringing that up, because it's an excellent point to pay attention to.
And of course, these are going to be issues that affect an entire families, not just the person with the illness. So what are the signs that may alert friends or family or even coworkers? And as we saw in the example from Washington, the Navy Yard, what are the signs that someone may be suffering from a mental illness, not just, you know, being overtired or something like that?
Yeah, okay. Well, there's several things that are just pretty much common sense, but perhaps it's worthwhile to mention them. Changes in behavior are a big red flag. If the person has a normal pattern of behavior that you're accustomed to, and all of a sudden they're doing something different, you need to start asking questions to yourself, at least, about what's going on. And if you have that kind of a relationship with the person, to ask, him or her what they might be experiencing, and even to tell them why you're concerned. Changes in their personality as well. If the person is normally outgoing, they become very introverted and very isolated, that would be something to watch for. Or if the person is usually very, very quiet and all of a sudden they're extraordinarily outgoing and it seems strange to you, it'd be good to go ahead and follow up on that. Another thing would be any kind of conversation that you might hear, any talk by that person about being in distress, if they're ruminating, thinking a lot about the issue of death or about things, you know, following their death, or if they begin to give things away, or their circumstances. They may not do or say anything that is a red flag to you, but it may be that you know that their circumstances have been dramatic. Someone very important to them has passed away or been assaulted, or there's been a robbery or a fire or anything that you know is very, very stressful. Just keep an eye on the person and see how they're doing. Ask them, you know, what they might be thinking or experiencing. And another thing that I would just like to add is that sometimes folks, they may suspect that another person might be considering harming themselves, but they are sometimes afraid to say anything about it because they're thinking that, wow, if I say anything about it to that person, it might give them the idea. Well, if they are already thinking about it, they already have the idea. And all the folks who are expert in the areas of suicide assessment really encourage us to ask and say, have you thought about hurting yourself? And don't be afraid to say that, and just listen to what the person might have to say. And then you, once you begin a dialogue with them, you can make a decision about how best to encourage that person to get help.
If you're in a situation where you've pretty much assessed that your relative needs help, but they're very stubborn about it. I mean, how do you convince someone? This is a common problem that because I think the average person's going, oh no, I don't need any help. I'm fine. Just leave me alone. But at some point, you've got to get them there. How do you do that?
That's a tricky situation. The most important thing is to stay by them and support them and be with them and find ways that will motivate and encourage them. Sometimes we have to spend a little bit more time thinking on what motivates this specific individual in our lives and what might be an incentive to get some help. Maybe offering to go with them. Maybe there's someone else in the community that they trust and that they are willing to listen to wholeheartedly. So you can engage that person to motivate that loved one. Hey, let's go do this.
I think it depends a lot on your relationship with the person. If the person is a coworker, but not a friend, for example, there's probably a system set up within your organization where there's someone that you can talk to about your concerns. If they happen to be a friend, then your relationship would be more like a family member in terms of really expressing concern and encouraging the person to get help. There are within the community, for example, pastors or priests or rabbis or other religious leaders who might be able to intervene in a way that would be very helpful. Those are some of the ones that come to mind immediately.
Who would be the preferred person? All right, if they agree, all right, I do need to get help, and you have a number of options available. What would be the most recommended way to get started?
Well, I think that it depends a lot on what you think is happening with the person. Usually, if a person has a family doctor, that might be a good place to start. If they've got a good relationship with a pastor, that might be a good place to start, too, especially if the person is reluctant to just to walk to into a mental health clinic, and some people are. Certainly, if they're willing to do that, that would be great. But finding a trusted friend or family member or someone, like I said before, either a religious leader or someone like that might be a good way to go.
The number to call tonight to participate in Health Matters this evening is 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. We welcome your questions or comments. My guests are Laura Bruscia-Hamm, the Executive Director of the Center for Families in Shreveport, and Dr. Richard Price, who's a clinician at the same Center for Families. And before we go on, why don't you just talk a little bit about what the Center for Families is?
Sure, thanks. Well, the Center for Families, we've been around since 1889, and we started out as an orphanage, but we've always really tried to pay attention to the trends and the needs of the community. And so since the 70s, really strongly, we really honed in the need to provide counseling to our community. We offer a variety of counseling services, you know, as we listed the different diagnoses earlier, and many, many more. But, you know, we have people that come in for all kinds of reasons, some for a little bit more on one end of the spectrum, a little bit more severe challenges in life where maybe they have to come in weekly for, you know, up to a year or longer. And then other people might come in one or two times dealing with some brief anxiety, a loss of a loved one, and trying to move beyond and past those challenges that have come up in their lives. But we also have some specific programs. One, it's called HEAL, Helping Everyone Abused to Live, that is geared for individuals who have experienced some form of abuse. Many of our clients that do come in that program have experienced some sex assault, domestic violence, various forms of physical abuse, lots of psychological, emotional abuse, or a combination thereof. It can also be if it happened to your child and you're trying to process all of that. And so not only does your child need the assistance, but you do as well. And that's our HEAL program. We've got Triple P, which is the positive parenting program, that it's evidence-based. It's been piloted for 30 years internationally, known and proven to work. It's a beautiful program set up to work with parents who have children 13 and under that are trying to really increase their positive parenting skills. We also do some autism work as well.
So if someone does have an issue, that's a good place to get started. And I think that throughout our entire region, of course, because we're much larger than just Shreveport-Bossier, we cover a huge region. There are places like that in most of our communities, and maybe we can come back to that, and you can make some recommendations as to where people can find help there. But we're going to take a question from our next caller. This is David from Shreveport. David, thank you for holding on. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Sure. Good evening. This is directed more towards Dr. Rice. I have a sleep disorder where I'm physically exhausted, I'm relaxed, I'm in my bedroom, and all the lights are down and there's no noises, but my mind is like a TV with someone changed the remote 100 times. I mean, I cannot turn off the TV for anything, and I don't have a general practitioner. But my question is related to, I've seen physicians in the past, and most of them say you need to just relax, or you need to avoid anything like caffeine or something like that. But I know for a fact that when I used to date an RN, she actually had access to Xanax, and she gave me some, and it was like a miracle drug. And I'm not a person that uses narcotics, but I mean, it was just the difference between night and day. I'm finding doctors that are very reluctant to prescribe medications because it seems to be something that they feel. I don't know what the reason for it, but I just see there's a general consensus with physicians to not prescribe narcotics, even if the patient say, I've used in the past, it's worked for me. And my question is, why is that so, and what do I have to do to get something like that to be able to help me sleep and function on a daily basis?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm a psychologist and not a physician. My recommendation for you, though, would be that you find a good psychiatrist, because they would have just a tremendous background in terms of helping people with sleep problems and knowing which medications would be most likely to be helpful and not harmful. So that would be my first recommendation to you. There are other physicians, too, many times neurologists, specialize in sleep disorders. So it sounds like you have struggled a lot, and you really owe it to yourself to get a good evaluation and find someone who can give you some help.
Well, can I ask one other question? Do you find this a common occurrence among people that you see that say, I just have such a hectic life. I have stress at work. I have stress at home. I have a mile-long to-do list. And when they go to bed, they just aren't able to shut off their thinking process and have a good night's sleep. I don't think it's abnormal. I think I know a lot of people in the same situation where it doesn't seem to be an unusual occurrence that happens to adults.
Well, I will say this, that I think that disrupted sleep can make you very vulnerable to a lot of different issues, both physical and psychological. And even though you may know some other people who are struggling from something with something similar, I would still encourage you to go ahead and get a good psychiatric evaluation and see if someone can give you some help. Because over the long run, I think it might be not to your best interest to just to kind of ignore it and say, well, that's the way things are.
I've got a question that's somewhat related to that, though, because we're in such, modern society is a lot different than the society of 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Do you think the changes in how we live as a society have definitely affected the number of people who are suffering from mental health issues, or has it remained basically the same and we just didn't hear about it back then? So what's the relationship between our environment and mental health?
Are you thinking about mental health in general or sleep disorders?
Well, in general. I would say relating to all of that.
That's a very broad question, and there are probably many people who have studied it in detail, but it seems like there are quite a few challenges nowadays that perhaps we didn't have some years ago, and certainly that would be true even within the short span of 50 years, let's say. I'm thinking about the amount of information that's available to us, and not just available, but available instantaneously. And I think that many people, you'll hear them talk about information overload. I do think mm-hmm. that's an issue, and it's kind of hard to know, to sort it out and decide what's really important. And I think that certainly in the computer age, the internet age, and all the different social media, that becomes an even larger problem. And in addition to that, I think the expectations that particularly young parents put upon themselves to have their children involved in many, many, many activities may reach a point of diminishing return. And I think it would be good if you could perhaps seek some advice from a trusted friend or, again, a religious leader, someone who might help you to just kind of wisely decide, these things are really important. I really want to focus my energy and channel my children in these areas and not feel like I have to try to do everything. And I think that's probably true at work as well. So often we accept the assumption that we've got to do everything and do everything perfectly, but quite honestly, that can really burn us out if we do that.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very valid question, and maybe even within the last 10 years, the quickness of life and the instantaneous that has come into our lives with everything at our fingertips. It just seems like everything has to be so quick and we have to respond that quickly. There are those of us that might have certain jobs also that when we get home and you come home at a late hour, you've got so much energy that is still built up from your work. And many of us have rituals in order to bring us down to that calmer level before we can go to sleep. Then there are those that can be completely exhausted and going so quick that they can just crash and fall asleep when they do go home. But mm-hmm. I think it's important to think about, are you eating certain foods before you go to bed? How's your exercise regimen? And what time of the day are you doing those things? And also, again, paying attention to those rituals, as Dr. Price was saying, trying to find things to hone in and spend time with and not feel like you have to do everything, and being able to learn to let go so that your mind can calm down and maybe get to that state. Some of us can do that. Some of us need the extra help.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add a personal note. Okay. As I reflect on my life, my children are grown now, but I just remember, coaching soccer and many, many, many activities. And in retrospect, think that it would have been good maybe to have spent a little bit more time just listening to the kids, not talking so much, mm-hmm. and just listening to them, kind of accompany them in some mm-hmm. of their activities, but be really sensitive to what was happening with them. And then apropos of what Laura was saying, I know some people, in terms of rituals, say that when they're driving home from work, when they cross Uri or when they cross whatever street it might be, they turn the office off and they're at home. And the same way going to work, they turn off family issues as they're going to work. So that might be helpful to somebody.
My guests are Dr. Richard Price, clinician at the Center for Families, and Laura Bruchaham, who's the executive director of the Center for Families. And your calls are welcome. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 and be a part of this edition of Health Matters. We do have one person on hold right now, Chris from Mansfield. I'm going to get to you in just a second, but we have an earlier question that came in. And this is from someone who didn't want to go on the air, and that's perfectly okay. We'll be happy to relay your question into the control room. This is from Anonymous in Shreveport. In regard to mental health issues and gun violence, and I'm sure this is prompted by the events last week, how does your practice deal with people with mental health issues who are also gun owners?
Wow, that's a good question.
Usually that issue does not come up unless the person, for some reason, is suspected to be either suicidal or homicidal, in which case it becomes a very critical issue. And one of the things we have to do is to inquire about the availability of a means to harm themselves or to harm somebody else, and that would include any kind of weapon, not just guns, any kind of weapon, as well as other things that might be potential risk factors.
All right, we're going to go to the phones right now. This is Chris from Mansfield. Thanks for holding on. What's your question this evening?
My question this evening is, what type of ramifications are we seeing associated with mental health illness with the social media and with all the apps? We have instant friends. We have instant information. We have instant contact. I've seen people that go without their cell phone for an hour, and it's like you put them in solitary confinement. What are the ramifications of that?
Chris, that's a great question. It's visiting with the clinicians, you know, oftentimes I hear clinicians talking just in general how, you know, clients, and including themselves as clinicians ourselves, that, you know, we're so attached to the cell phone and the instant messages that we need to get from various sources that it has become a stress factor. And so oftentimes we want to ask people to, you know, try not to pay attention to that for the hour that they might be with us, or even if it's you with someone else that you're dealing with at that very moment. But I would have to say it seems to have increased stress factors in our lives. And going back to that idea of that everything is so quick, you know, we're not taking our time and waiting around for that snail mail to come through and the importance and the beauty in that anymore. And so when we're waiting to hear from someone and we don't, we get upset. We get maybe worried that something happened, and so it increases the stress factor, and then that spills out into other areas if we don't manage it properly.
I would just add to that that the issue of boundaries enters in here, I believe. You know, I don't think we're very good necessarily at defining boundaries for ourselves, and sometimes there are things that we enjoy that are fun to do, but they can, after a while, become perhaps not an obsession, but they're very dominating, and they control and use up a lot of our time and energy. We wind up not doing things that we know are important, that are higher on our priority list, because we're spending a lot of time doing other things. I know of a pastor who felt that maybe he was watching more television than he felt he wanted to, really. And so his solution was just to disconnect the cable for many months. And I think he's been satisfied with that. I know another, again, a personal comment is that my daughter-in-law continues to ask, when am I going to get an iPhone or a smartphone?
And how old is she?
Well, she's 40, but okay. but and she's with it in with regard to social media, and I'm not. Mm-hmm. But quite honestly, I don't really think I want to do that because I know my tendency is just to want to know things mm-hmm. quickly, and I'm resisting that.
Right.
All right. The number to call this evening with your question, 800-552-8502. And we do have another caller, we didn't get your name. So caller from Shreveport, go ahead with your question.
Is that me?
That is you indeed.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't actually have a question. I just had a comment.
Okay.
That my wife and I have been using the Center for Families over on Olive in Shreveport. And we have had some very tough struggles. And I'll tell you right now, there's no way we would have ever been able to make it through and be where we are today if it was not for the assistance that y'all provide there. Mm. And to anybody out there, if you are going through something and it really matters, professional help might be what you need to do to get over that ego hump. And I tell you right now, my counselor in specific, I won't say her name, but she's a very beautiful woman and she is very good at what she does. And y'all seem to have a very well-rounded group of people up there. And anybody that's on the fence, you need to get off of it. Go ahead and, you know, give them a shot.
Thank you so much.
That's all I wanted to say. Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing.
In ways that, I mean, I can't even begin to thank y'all or my counselor. Like I said, without y'all, we wouldn't be where we are. There's no way. So like I said, if it matters and it's serious, give it a shot.
All right. Well, thanks for calling with that, which brings me back to something I was referring to earlier, because, of course, your center is in Shreveport, but all communities, or most communities, hopefully, mm-hmm. have facilities like that. So where are some good places that people can turn? Are there any, you know, places that you can look up online to find a place, or any places that you know of that would be a good source?
Well, let me start by saying that thanking this last caller for his call, because he mentioned the word ego, and sometimes that's a big obstacle to overcome before seeking care. But I would just like to say that, you know, we don't know who may be listening, but if there is a mental health emergency, you can always call 911 and get a rapid response. There's also a suicide prevention hotline, which is area code 3989. I'm going to repeat that. Area code 318-221-3989. And then you also can go to the emergency room at any hospital, and they will help you. However, Brentwood Hospital has a mental health, inpatient mental health unit, and as does Willis Knight and South. And I won't give those numbers, but I'll just say that you can call them as well. Another thing of a lot of importance is the issue of abuse. If there's an issue where a child is being abused or neglected, the number for the Department of Children and Family Services statewide is 855-452-5437. Again, that's 855-452-5437. There are other numbers that are equally important about domestic violence, alcohol or drug abuse problems, compulsive gambling. If anyone would call our center, we'd be happy to get that information to you.
And if you'll leave that information with us also, we'll see about getting that posted along with tonight's program, by the way, which will be available for download or streaming on our website at redriverradio.org. Two callers from Texas. We're going to go to them next. This is Susan from Jefferson, Texas. Susan, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Yes. I have a condition that when I sleep, my body becomes paralyzed, which is normal when you're sleeping or dreaming, but I wake up while it's happening and I can't move. Is there a diagnosis for that?
Would you say that again, ma'am? I'm sorry.
Okay. Is there a diagnosis for this phenomenon that I've experienced? Normally when you sleep and dream, your body becomes paralyzed, but you're asleep. I've been falling asleep and I become paralyzed, but then I wake up, I come into full consciousness, and I can't move. Have you ever heard of any kind of diagnosis for that?
Ma'am, I've heard of symptoms similar to that, but I surely wouldn't want to try to give a diagnosis in a situation like this. I would recommend that you do seek help. It sounds like it's something that could be quite disturbing to you and frustrating.
All right, Susan, thank you for your question this evening. Our next caller from Dallas, this is Lisa. Thank you for waiting on hold. Go ahead with your comment or question.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I work with a population of individuals applying for disability benefits, many of whom have mental health issues, possibly have been treated in the past or not. Most of them are of very low income and limited means. I'd like to be able to give them advice about where to seek low cost or even free mental health care in the Shreveport area. Can you help?
Let me mention one place that you might want to try. That's the Shreveport Mental Health Center. They have not only a sliding scale, but they also have a staff psychiatrist. Laura?
Yeah, and of course, there's besides ourselves offering a sliding fee scale, there's also the Samaritan Counseling Center that offers mental health counseling services at low rates, trying to meet the financial needs of each of the individuals. And a lot of people don't know that their insurance plans typically will cover mental health, whether it's for the family, the individual, or couple situation. So it's always a great idea to check out with your insurance company.
Speaking about insurance, are there any aspects to the Affordable Care Act that in any way benefit any provisions that help treatment of mental health?
Well, I know that there's definitely going to be a stronger push, and we'll see that come to fruition. I'm not exactly sure what the details are at this time, but definitely a push to make sure that everybody will have access to mental health. It's a huge phenomenon right now with the push and getting into the school systems and increasing the amount of mental health available on site, as well as better plans when tragedies happen or to help prevent those tragedies or crisis situations at schools. But in general, for those of us are caring and will be caring insurance in the future, there will be mental health availability and affordability for everyone.
The number to call to participate in Health Matters this evening, 800-552-8502. My two guests, Laura Brusha-Ham, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Families, also Dr. Richard Price, a clinician also with the Center for Families. And your questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes or so, so if you have been waiting to call, don't hesitate, because just about 10 more minutes left in the program. One caller who sent in a text message asks, what is the standard follow-up for an attempted suicide after hospitalization?
Well, I don't know that there's a standard follow-up. It will depend a lot on the individual and what their circumstances are. One extremely important thing is their social support system. In addition to that, to have follow-up, perhaps they might be on medication, so they would need to be followed by a psychiatrist, although in some cases a family practitioner might do that as well, but typically a psychiatrist. If they're not on medication, I think they would, ordinarily most folks would recommend that they get very early assessment by an outpatient facility and do a very thorough evaluation of the individual, and to obtain release of information from the client so that there could be a free exchange of information between the hospital and the outpatient treatment facility. And then it would depend entirely on the individual and their circumstances, but if the person continues to be borderline suicidal, then you would need to be constantly reevaluating whether or not they would need to be returned to the hospital. If the person seemed to be doing quite well, you would still want to do all you could to build a very good support system for them and to monitor quite closely what's going on with them.
All right. Mike from Shreveport's waiting on hold. Mike, go ahead with your question.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Question is the mental health, I guess, population or the problems getting worse and more severe with technology, or that certain parts of the country are having more issues? Because I grew up in a big city on the West Coast, and I didn't know anybody with bipolar. You know, a lot of people are wacky and a little extreme out there as it is, but I didn't hear about bipolar until I moved out here about 10 years ago. That was more more prominent, I guess. More people I know here have it as adults.
I don't know if it's more prevalent, but I do think that we hear more about mental illness and mental health problems now than we did in the past. That's a good question. Laura, did you have a comment on that?
Actually, according to the CDC, a report that came out in 2012 is that one in every two Americans will experience some form of mental illness, and that those that are diagnosed, 80 to 90% of that, if given proper treatment, it'll be manageable and possibly even cured. So I definitely agree with Dr. Price is saying. I don't know if it's necessarily more. I can say this is that we're seeing more of it readily available at our fingertips, whether it's through the news or movies and shows, commercials. It's just a little bit more prevalent in our face with just discussed a lot more easily, I guess.
Right. I wanted to ask, because we've been mostly quoting numbers referring to adults primarily, but of course, you know, kids have problems too, and maybe this also relates to somewhat earlier when we were talking about social media and all that, because of course teens, well, even younger than teens, I mean, you know, just about every kid knows how to work their electronic device, and they're all communicating. For a parent, what should you watch for? Are there some warning signs that alert you to, hey, you know, you have a child that's in trouble and might need some help?
And about 13.7 million American children suffer from some sort of mental health challenge. So lots of cues. You know, if your child is typically an average student at school and the grades are dropping, or all of a sudden they're becoming a little bit more less involved and isolated, you know, questions that might come to mind are they being bullied, or something going on at school? Are they afraid to report about anything? Are they reacting to loud sounds in a different manner that they hadn't before? Are they suddenly uncontrollably crying or talking more than usual? So if any time you notice anything different that your child doesn't typically demonstrate, it's definitely a reason to let your ears go up a little bit and sit down and talk to them. Hey, you know, I noticed that you haven't been as happy and when you come home from school like usual, and we haven't been chatting much. What's going on? You know, just sit down and listen. Like Dr. Price said earlier, it's really important to watch and listen and not try to overload and bombard, especially when it comes to children. And then if you do discover something, then definitely create a plan of action. One of the preschool teachers that I know personally recently approached me and talked about her niece who's in third grade, who has been recently bullied and refused to go to school. Well, as an auntie, she knew that that was not an option. So I helped her brainstorm about a support system and talking to the school, getting the counselor involved, getting the parents and the child that it was bullying her niece involved. Mm-hmm. And it took a few days, but things have turned around. And now this child that was bullying severely is now asking her, can I help you? And the teachers are monitoring all of this. So support systems are really, really important, and also paying attention to what is changing, what is shifting, and listening.
I would just add to that, if I could.
Sure.
I think that, in addition to what Laura was talking about with regard to problems with kids at school, sometimes a parent might see a big change in their behavior at home. Perhaps they might be picking on younger siblings a lot more than before, or in some way just acting quite differently. And another thing that would be a big cause for concern would be anything that leads you to suspect that they're having problems with substances, either alcohol or other kind of drugs, which are so common today.
All right. And we have another question that's coming in via text, which is perfectly okay. And this is this may not be one that could be easily answered unless you're in politics. In spite of most health insurance that can cover mental health, why does Medicare cap it at 65%?
I can't answer that.
I wouldn't
one.
Be
is that,
qualified.
That's not. I was going to say that's yeah, that probably is a difficult question. Yeah. But you were saying earlier that most health insurance plans do have mental health.
They do. They do. And it's surprising that when people actually call their insurance plan. And sometimes employers just aren't aware that it's part of the coverage or just, you know, haven't spent that much time to maybe feature it. So and it's nobody's fault, but it, you know, as someone who holds insurance, it would definitely behoove you to just make a simple phone call and find out how many sessions does it cover. Some of them are indefinite. You could go every week. Mm-hmm. And others cover marital, family, and the individual, of course.
I don't know very much about it, but I do understand that and of course, a lot of things are in the offing right now with regard to changes, but according to what's called the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, there's an expectation that any new insurance companies, health insurance companies, would have equity for mental health coverage, and that there's also going to be a requirement that those who are existing measure up to that standard too. How that will work out, I'm not sure.
All right. Go ahead, Laura.
I just wanted to comment on a couple of things. The question
sure.
earlier about, you know, with teens that you're, or young kids that you mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of times as parents or guardians, we may not be comfortable approaching certain subjects, and that's okay. And so, you know, it's also quite all right to find someone, again, that your child might relate to. To pull in on certain conversations if you're comfortable with that. And if you feel that they're going to be comfortable with that too, because as guardians, we need support too. We don't always have all the answers. So paying attention, of course, is important of what's shifting and changing. And then trying to seek some support for that for yourself as well.
Right.
And then just real quick for Susan,
sure.
who called earlier about
uh-huh.
being paralyzed when she, you know, with the dreaming and what's going on. Mm-hmm. I would definitely recommend, Susan, that you go visit a sleep clinic or talk to your physician to refer you to be tested while you're sleeping so that they will monitor you physically and chemically what's going on with your body to give you a diagnosis and help you out.
All right. My guests have been Laura Bruchet-Ham, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Families, and Dr. Richard Price, a clinician at the Center for Families. And this, I think, edition of Health Matters has been really interesting. We're just kind of scratching the surface here and can get a lot more in detail. I wondered if we have about a minute and a half, if you would repeat again, you had made some recommendations about where people can turn if they believe they need help.
Now, let me say again that mental health emergencies, a person can call 911 anytime. There's a suicide prevention hotline. It's 318-221-3989. In the Shreveport area, Brentwood Hospital, Willis-Knighton South Hospital, and LSU Medical Center all have inpatient hospitalization capability. Child abuse or neglect, the Department of Children and Family Services is 855-452-5437. For the Louisiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence, it is 888-411-1333. And then for alcohol or drug abuse or dependence, there are several numbers to call, but let me give you this one. It's 318-222-1289 for the Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse.
All right. I want to thank you both so much for being here for this edition of Health Matters. Health Matters
thank
is a production
you.
Of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Bill Beckett, Wally Derleth, and Daniel Gordy. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. You can download a copy of this program from our website, redriverradio.org. I'm Kermit Poling. Good night.